14. Path of Destiny. They come at him one at a time, an endless stream, each warrior in turn charging toward honorable single combat. Then they come two at a time. By the time they begin to come in groups, they have to scramble over bodies of their dead comrades to reach him, a pile of bodies, a pile that becomes a wall, a rampart. Ganar Rysod builds a fortress of the dead. From a safe vantage point, behind a twisted curve of durasteel that had once been part of the great door, Numanor watched with appalled fascination. All he could see through the smoke and the mass of warriors who pressed forward to engage the mad Jedi were flashes of brilliant purple, sometimes joined by the Jedi himself as he leapt and whirled and spun, always in motion, always attacking, stabbing and slashing, littering the atrium with corpses and severed limbs. "This is insane." Numanor turned to the warrior commander at his side. "Can't you simply blow him up? Gas him? Something?" "Nay." The commander's facial scars flushed pale blue. "He faces us with honor. Would you have warriors of the Yuuzhan Vong show less honor than an infidel Jedi?" "Space, your honor. Don't you understand? There's a Jedi in the well of the world brain, and that Jedi is Jason Solo." He used the name as though it could conjure devils, and perhaps it could. Only a devil could have slain the Voxen Queen. Only a devil could have slaughtered the Duryams and Shapers and warriors in the nursery, yet still wormed its evil way into Numanor's trust, to the point where he, Numanor himself, had ushered this terrifyingly lethal Jedi into the one place on Yuuzhan Tar where he might slay the whole planet. "Jason Solo is alone with the world brain. The world brain is well able to defend itself." To Numanor's other side stood Chigong Hul, the Shaper Lord. "Matters of honor aside, we cannot use overpotent explosives nor poison gases. The world brain would be in greater danger from a clumsy attempt at rescue than it could ever be from a single Jedi." "This is no ordinary Jedi," Numanor said feelingly. "You have no idea what he is capable of. We have to get in there. We have to stop him." The commander snapped a series of orders, and a squad of heavy infantry lumbered toward the archway, their head-to-toe overlapping plates of Von Dune crab armor gleaming in the slime light. He glanced back at Numanor. "We will be in soon enough. Remain calm, Executor." "Space, you're calm, too. You do seem a bit, overwrought," Chigong Hul murmured. His mouth tentacles twitched. "One might wonder if you felt in some way, responsible for this." Numanor opened his mouth, took a breath, started to say something, changed his mind, started to say something else, then closed it again. The Shaper Lord's mouth tentacles braided themselves into a shape subtly obscene. Numanor looked away. He was about 1 second away from ripping those ridiculous tentacles right off that smug, smirking bureaucrat's face and eating them. A few strides down the causeway, among the milling crowd of priests and warriors, he saw Vergere. She met his eye and, with a twitch of her head, motioned for him to follow. Oh, he'd follow all right, he thought as he excused himself and paced after her. He had some choice words for that little creature. She moved well downslope into the blue-white sunlight and stopped, with one hand holding a leafy vertical branch of the road trees. Numanor was already snarling by the time he reached her. "Do you know what your student has done? That sniveling traitor has betrayed us, and it's all your fault." "Perhaps it is." Her fluting voice was cheerful as ever. "But let us be clear on the issue of fault, eh, Executor? What is important is not whose fault this truly is. All that matters is whom Sabung La will choose to blame for it, yes?" Numanor pulled fleshless lips back over needle-sharp teeth. He could imagine all too well what Sabung La would do, once word of this disaster reached his fanatic ears. "And why do you come to me now?" "Because you should take me with you." He went absolutely still. "Take you with me?" he asked with studied blankness. "You'll need me." "I saved the life of Luke Skywalker's wife. With me at your side, the New Republic might not simply shoot you on sight." Numenor admitted silently that she might have a point, but his face revealed nothing. "You think I have some sort of escape plan? Executor, please." Vergere chided knowingly. "You always have an escape plan. This time you have something even better. A secret coral craft grown below the well." I have nothing of the sort." How could she possibly know? A concealed access way on the far side of the well, that would open only to him, led to the coral craft he'd bribed a shaper to seed months ago, during the earliest stage of the Galactic Senate's conversion into the Well of the World Brain. "You cannot possibly think, Executor, again. Please. Are you the only one who can bribe a shaper? And all the tending and care of your secret coral craft while it matured? St! Enough." He glanced back over his shoulder up the causeway. Though the commander had turned away to observe the battle, Chagong Hul still watched Numenor expectantly. To leave now would be too suspicious. He might never make it. Vergere seemed somehow to read his mind. "Executor, if we do not flee now, there will be no flight at all. There will be no ship." She stood on tiptoe to lean close to him and whispered, "Jason Solo will steal it." The surface of the slime pool closes over Jason Solo like lips, warm as blood. He does not feel it. Knotted ropes of tentacles stretch wide his arms, bind close his legs, circle garrote tight his throat. Their coarsely scaled hide rasps blood through his skin, blood that trails him in a fractal tree spiral gelled motionless in the slime. Tentacles twist him and turn him and bend him, pulling him deeper through the slime that fluoresces yellow, gold, and scarlet around him, blazing colors that shift with his motion and surge from contact with the heat of his body. He does not see them. At the deepest depths of the slime pool, the tentacles hold him face up, his back to a ring of jagged rubble. That ring of rubble once had been the base of the Chief of State's podium from which his mother had so often declaimed. The tentacles gather him in, gather him up, toward a body vast and billowing, black curves of flesh bulging between translucent green sheets and ropes of viscera. The tentacles spring from a fleshy ring around a mouth gaping and hungry, and from either side of that emptily chewing maw stare immense eyes that glow yellow with suspicious malice. Jason does not notice. His attention is filled with the hollow in his chest. His empty center rings with anger and mistrust and hungry triumph, the emotions of the world brain which has caught the former friend who tried to murder it. The former friend it had trusted and by whom it had been betrayed. Mobile teeth like swords protrude from humps of muscle like multiple tongues and begin to circle and clash within the tentacle-ringed mouth. Jason can answer only with regret and sadness. "Yes, I betrayed you. I taught you to trust, and I taught you what it means to trust a traitor." He cannot teach it forgiveness. He has not learned that lesson yet himself. There is too much he will never forgive. The tentacles contract, drawing him into the gaping maw, and the sword teeth close upon his flesh. He does not recoil in fear. He does not resist. He does not struggle. Instead, he opens himself. In his most secret center, that gap in his being that once fed him pain, he offers an embrace. Into the hollow in his center he pours compassion, absolute empathy, perfect understanding. He accepts the pain he caused the Duryam with his betrayal. He shares with the Duryam the pain that betrayal had caused him. He shares with the Duryam all his experience with the spectrum of life, the featureless whiteout of agony, the red tide of rage, the black hole of despair, the gamma sleet of loss, and the lush verdure of growing things, the grays of stone and duracrete, the glistening of gemstones and transparent steel, the blue-white sizzle of the noonday sun and its exact echo in a lightsaber's blade. He shares how much he loves it all, for all these things are all one thing, pain and joy, loss and reunion, life and death. To love any is to love all, for none can exist without every other. The universe, the Force, all is one. The Yuuzhan Vong and the species of the New Republic, Jason and the World Brain. When I betrayed you, I betrayed myself. When I killed your siblings, I killed pieces of myself. You may kill me, but I will live on in you. We are one. And Jason cannot tell if those words come from him to the World Brain or from the World Brain to him, for Jason and the World Brain are only different faces of the same thing. Call it the universe, or the Force, or existence. Those are only words. They are half-truths. Less. They are lies. The truth is always greater than the words we use to describe it. The skirl of light played along Amphistaff, a thrusting bind that sizzles disintegrating energy through the web of skin between a Yuuzhan Vong thumb and forefinger where hand meets Amphistaff. A world whirl of airborne somersault over the heads of two warriors lunging side by side, and their boneless collapse as a single lightsaber slash opens the napes of two necks and unstrings their limbs. The astonished blink of a warrior's eyes as an amethyst shaft of energy spears into his open mouth, angling upward to burn open a 3-centimeter-wide tunnel from his hard palate through the roof of his skull. Of such brief flickers is built the death of Ganner Rysode, burnt milk reek of Yuuzhan Vong blood sizzling into smoke on his blade, lines of burning ice that are the slices left in his flesh by Amphistaffs, cold flame of Amphistaff venom consuming his nerves. These are mere flicks of melody in Ganner's symphony of the Force. The Force does more than give him strength, more than lift him, spin him. The Force surges through his veins to tune his heart to the rhythm of the universe. He has become the Force, and the Force has become him. He is not directly aware of the sequence of his death. Time vanished along with fear and doubt and pain in that eternal second when he surrendered his self-command. Standing in the archway waiting for the Yuuzhan Vong, Ganner realized that this right now, right here, was what his whole life had been for. The day of his birth set his feet upon this path. Every triumph and tragedy, every foolish stunt and humiliation, each random useless twist of cruel fate built a pressure within him, piled up in tidal surge behind the dikes of his control. Those dikes had been built by his parents, trying to smooth the rough edges of his arrogance. They had been built by the mocking laughter of his playmates, when they jeered his every attempt to impress them. They had been built even by Luke Skywalker's Jedi training. A Jedi doesn't show off, Ganner. Fighting is not a game. For the Jedi, combat is failure. It is a tragedy. When blood must be shed, a Jedi does so quickly, surgically, with solemn reverence, with grief. Ganner tried for so long, tried so hard, to be what everyone told him he was supposed to be, tried to control his flair for the dramatic, for the elegant, the graceful, the artistic, tried to be a good son, a good friend, a humble man, a good Jedi. But in the archway he finds the end of trying. There is reason no longer to resist the truth of himself. Play-acting the hero's part is not only permissible, it is necessary. To hold the archway, it is not enough to merely wound and kill, is not enough to be calm and surgical and grieving. To hold the archway, he must not only slaughter, but slaughter effortlessly, carelessly, laughingly, joyfully. To hold the archway, he must dance and whirl and leap and spin, calling out for more opponents, more victims. He must make them hesitate to face him. He must make them fear. He had spoken the words. He had found a magical incantation to crack the dikes within him and unleash the flood. None shall pass. He wields the blade of a fallen hero, but now he is the hero, and it is others who fall. He is rising. The force thunders through him, and he thunders through the force, letting slip the bonds of control, leaving aside conscious thought, answering only the surge of his passion and his joy. He finds power undreamed of. He has become the battle. He is not directly aware of the corpses that litter the tunnel, that his feet nimbly avoid of their own accord. He is not directly aware of the warped sheets of durasteel that he has drawn from the wreckage of the great door, sheets that spin and tumble around him to become anvils for the hammer of thud bugs and shields to shelter his flanks. He is not directly aware of the coral-embedded statues from the atrium that he has caught in his force-powered dance, immense figures of the species of the New Republic that seem to come to life to fight in his cause, statues that lumber and rock and fall, crushing dozens and hundreds, remaking atrium into abattoir. No more is he aware of the texture of the coral that lines the walls, or the quality of the light, or the number of his opponents. Has he faced a dozen? 100? How many have been pulled back to safety after taking disabling wounds? How many lie dead in the brimstone smoke? He doesn't remember, for there is no memory. There is no past. There is no future. He is not even aware of himself, nor of the Yuuzhan Vong. He has become the warriors he fights, slaying himself with each who falls. There is no longer any such thing as a Ganarisode. There are no more Yuuzhan Vong, no more Jedi. There are only the dancers and the dance. The dance is all there is. From whirl of quarks to wheel of galaxies, all is motion. All is dance. All is. Numanor motioned for Vergier to wait while he took one last quick look around. Before him rose the coral mountain of the well. The half-finished thorn maze towered behind, empty of shapers. They'd all probably been drawn to the well's front by the noise of the battle. Distant explosions popped in stuttering a rhythm, punctuated by fainter shouts. Satisfied that they were unobserved, Numanor pulled aside a soft, moss-like sheet of false coral to reveal a hatch sphincter's nose-tongue. He stuck his hand inside it, still glancing around nervously while the nose-tongue tasted and analyzed the enzymatic secretions of his skin. A second later it recognized him, and a larger curtain of false coral nearby suddenly dimpled as a small, concealed hatch sphincter opened behind it. He motioned for Vergier to follow, and went in. Yorick coral gave way to age-grimed duracrete. The corridor became a labyrinth. As they threaded their way along, Numanor congratulated himself on the cleverness of his escape plan. No one had been within the well except Master Shapers and their assistants since its initial conversion had begun. No one was willing to risk the homicidal wrath of Chigong Hul, except for one Shaper whose greed had overcome his cowardice. Of all the Yuuzhan Vong, only that Shaper and Numanor himself had been aware that immense chambers, once the offices of the Old Republic's Chancellor, lay below the World Brain's pool. These chambers were blasted and broken. Damaged in the destruction of the Senate above, they had never been repaired. Numanor picked his way over mounds of rubble and through a jungle of twisted durasteel and dangling cable, leading Vergier through the wreckage. Down here some of the New Republic glow-globes still functioned. They had not been destroyed as heresies because only Numanor and his pet Shaper had known of their existence. He pulled himself over a bent girder, and there it was, long and sleek, sculpted for atmospheric speed, twinned Doven basils, one for motion, one for defense, surfaces angled to deflect sensors, flat, matte black, non-reflective to defeat visual targeting. The Shaper who had grown it had guaranteed this coral craft would be as fast as any in the Yuuzhan Vong fleet. Numanor had used the concealed hatch sphincter above to secretly visit the craft on several occasions while it grew, so that its pilot brain could be imprinted with Numanor's mental signature. While visiting, Numanor had often amused himself by contemplating how he had found a new use for the chambers that had once belonged to the legendary Palpatine. The defensive Dovenbasil would collapse a tunnel through the Durakreet and York Coral alike, opening it like a gate to the sky. The pilot brain was trained with the necessary recognition codes to pass the fleet cordon around the planet, and had coordinates for the jump into New Republic space already memorized. Once inside, nothing could touch him. Once inside, he would be safe. "Beautiful, isn't it?" he murmured as he put his hand to the coral craft's nose tongue. Its hatch gaped wide, instantly obedient. "This is the result, Verger, of contingency planning. I never assume success. This is why I always survive. I always have a contingency plan to cover any possible disaster." "Do you always?" Something in her voice froze him in place. "Any possible disaster?" Before he could even draw breath to ask what she meant, his unspoken question was answered by a sickeningly familiar sound. Snap hiss, hum. Slowly, glacially, afraid of what he'd see but unable to stop himself, Numanor turned toward a new light in the ruined office, light that sizzled green and struck white highlights off the black curves of his coral craft. To find himself staring into the terminal curve of a lightsaber's blade 1 centimeter from his nostrils. "A lightsaber is an interesting weapon," Verger said conversationally. "A blade unique in the history of warfare. A paradox, not unlike the Jedi who wield it. Those peaceful warriors who kill in the service of life. Have you ever noticed? The blade is round. It has no edge. But it is a lightsaber, which means it is nothing but edge. There is no part of this blade that does not cut. Curious, yes? Symbolic, one might say." "What?" His mouth opened, closed, opened again. He wanted to ask what she was doing. He wanted to ask where she had gotten a lightsaber. He wanted to ask any number of things, but all that would come from his mouth was, "What?" Again Verger seemed to read his mind. "It's Jason's," she chimed cheerfully. "I think he might want it back, don't you? You can't." "Yes, I can." She nodded toward the gloom beyond the coral craft. "I should be able to cut my way into the well easily enough. If you kill me—" Numanor began desperately. "Kill you? Don't be silly." Cables from the dangling jungle of wreckage suddenly writhed to life, whipping through the air to bind Numanor's limbs. They wrapped him tightly enough to squeeze a gasp from his lungs, then tied themselves in hideously complex knots. Verger watched all this happen, made it happen, Numanor realized, with a humorous expression on her face and a bright orange flare of her crest. "If I want you dead, all I have to do is leave you behind. Sabong La will take care of the rest." "But you can't leave me behind," Numanor said. He was beginning to recover his self-possession. "You can't fly my craft. It's imprinted on me. Only I can." "That may be true," she allowed, "but I doubt it. Your coal craft is, after all, a living creature, and Jason, you may have noticed, has a certain gift for making friends."
You're mad. This can't be happening."
"Executor," she said severely, cutting him short with a twitch of the light blade, "didn't I say Jason Solo will steal your ship?" Numanor could only gape. "When will you learn," she asked, shaking her head in mock sadness, "that everything I tell you is the truth?" Abruptly, the dance falters, stumbles, begins to limp. There is no one left to fight. Ganner sways, dizzy, dying, poisoned with amphistaff venom from scores of wounds. His blood paints the floor beneath his boots and the walls of the tunnel around him. Only the force holds him upright. A grinding rumble approaches, and soon he can see what makes this sound, what produces these tremors he feels shaking the floor. Something huge and dark,
trundling on curving knotted legs like buttresses, splayed claws flattening Yuuzhan Vong corpses heedlessly as it approaches. Its bulk is mailed with vast plates of horn, and a vast head swings slowly from side to side, like an AT-AT's control cabin in hunter-killer mode. Its massive jaws drip flame. Warriors advance along its flanks. I guess it was inevitable, Ganner thinks with a twinge of melancholy. Sooner or later the bad guys always bring up their armor. This is about to be over. He cannot face such a beast supported by infantry, and yet the force offers him one last trick. Though the force is blind to the warriors and the tank beast and the coral around them all, in it Ganner can feel the duricrete walls of the Senate, which form the well's skeletal structure. He can feel that the tunnel had been cut through any number of load-bearing members. He can feel that the duricrete around him is crazed with stress fractures, half-broken already and sagging under the unimaginable tons of the coral that surrounds it. Ganner smiles. The tank beast roars a gout of concentrated acid. With the force, Ganner angles a shard of the great door to form a durasteel shield that sluices the acid to one side so that it splashes to one wall. Coral smokes, dying, liquefying instantly. The shard of the great door begins to melt. Blast bugs zing toward him from the warriors, and the melting shard dances before him, deflecting them into the acid-burned wall. Their explosions splash liquid coral and duricrete splinters. Above their heads the building groans. Warriors flinch, glancing upward in sudden fear. The tank beast howls. Ganner laughs. The force is with him, and he has become once more the dancer. He has become the dance. With the force he reaches into the duricrete around them all, and he begins to shove. Jason was surprised by life. The teeth of the world brain had not closed upon him. Its tentacles had not ripped the flesh from his bones. He had not drowned in the slime pool, asphyxiating on phosphorescent goo. No Yuuzhan Vong warriors swarmed around him to drag him from the slime and carve the life from him with amphistaffs. Instead, a bubble of air had formed around him, and tentacles had cradled him like a sleeping child, and lips had closed over sword-edged teeth to touch him with a kiss. Because he was the world brain, and the world brain was him, and each was everything else. And Jason had learned that one can meet the universe and all its irrational pain, which means meeting oneself, with fear, or with hatred, or with despair. Or one can choose to meet it with love. Jason had chosen. But still, he was astonished to discover that the universe could love him back. At the far end of an infinite distance, which was the same as right here, he felt an oceanic roll of the force gathering an interstellar fortissimo of symphonic joy. At the same time, within the hollow at his center, he felt rage and pain and fierce hot combat, and he understood another reason why he was still alive. Ganner. He reached out with his feelings and gathered power from across the universe. Tentacles fell away from his arms and legs, and the air bubble around him collapsed. He brushed the world brain lightly with his fingertips, a goodbye to a friend. Then Jason Solo shot from the slime pool as though fired from a torpedo launcher. He burst into the brimstone smoke, his robe blazing with slime that trailed from him in shining ropes and dripped like falling stars. He sailed over the slime pool to alight at the bowl rim, where the coral met the bare durasteel of a Senate platform. He lifted his head, fixing his gaze upon the cantilevered bridgeway that stuck out into the well like a tongue from a mouth that belched smoke and scarlet flame, and the amethyst lightning of a lightsaber biting flesh. And he could hear a human voice up there. He could not make out words, but the tone was unmistakable. Ganner was laughing. Deep in the forest, Jason seized that bridgeway with the hands of his mind. One long, smooth tug would lift him to it, and he could reach Ganner's side and join in his fight, stand at his shoulder against the Yuuzhan Vong. "Jason, wait."
The words were spoken not loudly, but so perfectly resonant that they chimed in his ear as though the speaker were at his side. And she might as well have been. In the force he felt an invisible hand take his shoulder. He nodded to himself. "I should have known, somehow. I should have known you'd be here." Ruggiero stood only a few meters above and to his right on the coral-draped Senate platform that had once belonged to the delegation from Kashiyyk. "Come, Jason. Your sojourn in the lands of the dead is at an end. It is time once more to walk the bright fields of day." Instead of answering, he turned back toward the bridgeway above, but her force grip tightened on his shoulder. "You cannot save him, Jason. All you can do is die with him. He has chosen this destiny. The only aid you can offer is to honor his choice. You stand at the very gates of death. Life lies before you. If you turn back now, even for a single glance over your shoulder, you are lost." "What do you want me to do? I won't leave him. I won't." He turned on her. A wave of trembling started at the back of his neck and shivered out through his arms and down his legs. "I can't let people keep giving their lives for me." "He does not give his life for you. He gives your life to you. Will you refuse the gift of a dying man?" "I can't. Ruggiero, I can't just—" "In the story of your life, is this your best ending?" He reached into the force and gave a wrenching shove that twisted him free of her grip. "I won't leave him," she shrugged. "Then you'll be wanting this." She tossed something down to him. It spun lazily through the air, flashing silver in the slime light. He caught it instinctively. It was a lightsaber. It was his lightsaber. It felt strange in his hand, weird, alien. He had not seen it since the death of the Voxen Queen. The last time he'd held it, he'd been somebody else. A boy. A sad, conflicted boy searching desperately for anything he could be sure of, willing to die on a sure nothing rather than live for an uncertain something. She said, "Choose. And act." He looked at the flare of battle above. He ached to go, burnt to go, to find in himself the pure release, the cosmic symphony that he could feel echoing through Ganner, but he looked back at Ruggiero. "Every time you say that to me, it's a trick, as it is now," she admitted. "But it's not the same trick. The first time you were but a boy. You did not truly understand what you were throwing away. The second time, you were lost in the dark, and you needed flint and steel to spark a torch. Now, though, now, what are you, Jason Solo?" In an instant, it all flashed through him, from Cernpadal and Belkaden, through Duro and Mirker, to the Embrace of Pain, the Nursery, the Jedi Temple, and the Cavern Beast. He was no warrior. He was certain of that. Not like Jaina was or Anakin had been. He was no hero like Uncle Luke or his father, no great statesman like his mother or strategist like Admiral Ackbar or scientist like Danny Quee. He remembered that he didn't have to know what he was. All he had to do was decide. I guess," he said slowly, frowning down at the weapon in his hand, "I guess I'm a student." "Perhaps you are." Ruggiero nodded. "Then you are also a teacher, for the two are one. But to be such, you must learn, and you must teach. You must live." She was right. He knew she was right. He could feel it as surely as he'd ever felt anything. But Ganner, as he looked up, a new sun was born in the well of the world brain, somewhere deep in the tunnel above, a rising yellow glare that grew bright and white, that flared until Jason had to shield his eyes with his hand and turn away. The well shook, and he could feel sudden terror from the world brain as the cantilevered bridgeway and platform collapsed, plunging 100 meters to crash into the slime pool, and the world seemed to rock and tremble, and a blast of smoke and dust burst from the tunnel.
"What?" Jason gasped, coughing in the dust that smelled of burning blood and duracrete.
"What? Is that Ganner?
What's happening up there?"
"It may be Ganner. It may be a weapon of the Yuuzhan Vong. It makes no difference. Your choice is the same. Stay or go."
The glare from above died in a long ground-quake rumble and new billows of dust, and when Jason reached out once more through the force, Ganner was no longer there. In the hollow of his chest, the warriors who had fought him were similarly absent. Jason stared up at the mouth of the tunnel. He could see it now, choked with rubble. Then the platforms around it began to sag, to crumble, and slide down the bowl toward the slime pool. Even the gloom-shrouded ceiling high above seemed to droop, and he felt a warm hand on his shoulder and heard a warm whisper in his ear.
"Go." It sounded like Ganner.
He frowned at Vergere. She returned his gaze blankly. He would never know what had happened up there. He would never know if that voice he'd just heard had been Ganner's or another of Vergere's tricks. He would never really know, could never really know, much of anything. Truth is elusive, and questions are more useful than answers. But he knew this. Life is more a matter of choosing than of knowing. He could never know the eventual destination of his path, but he could always choose in which direction to take each step. He chose. "You're the one who's supposed to be my guide through the lands of the dead, right?" he said. "So go ahead and guide. Show me the way out of here."
She smiled down upon him fondly. "Of course," she said. "I was only waiting for you to ask."